Well, good evening. I'm coming to you from my office here at Emmanuel, but Rochelle and I are out of town. We are celebrating her birthday, and this is an important lesson, and you should have your handout that you picked up before the welcome and introduction of our guest tonight. I'd encourage you to take the handout and kind of follow it along, because we're going to do something a little bit different tonight. I appreciate Brian Salee recording this. He's at the back making sure that the sound is fine. I need you to pay close attention, because we're going to do something tonight that is important for the long run of this study, which will take us until after Easter, into the beginning, really, of summer. For those of you who are here for the first time, you missed our introductory lesson last Wednesday night, but you can listen to it via podcast, and you can pick up the notes after the study this evening. I want to take about 7 minutes right now to introduce you to the battle for Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, and the dispersion of the Jews in AD 70. Now, in a moment, you're going to see a pretty unusual presentation on the battle for Jerusalem in AD 70. It's one that we've kind of put together with permission. And some of you here tonight who maybe don't like history, you don't like the concept of war, why study battles, what's the purpose in it, I get all that. So in this introduction, I want to explain why you need to have an understanding of the importance of AD 70 and what occurred in that year when the Roman army, under the leadership of Titus, wiped out the city, destroyed the walls, tore down the temple so that not one stone was left standing on another, and the Jewish people, God's people from the Old Testament, were scattered all over the world. Why is that important to understand? Well, here's the principle. What happened in AD 70 was God orchestrated and from heaven to officially end the old covenant way of worship and inaugurate the new agreement that God has with the world. What is the old covenant way of worship? It's sacrifice, temple worship, rituals, festivals. That's the old way. What's the new way? Embrace the Son of God, and your sins will be forgiven. Kiss the Son, as the psalmist said, and your Creator embraces you. Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world, not just the Jews. He is the Messiah for all people, not just God's old covenant people. Now, how do we know that to be true? In fact, there are some today, my Jewish friends, Jewish scholars, people who love the Hebrew Scriptures, frankly, they're offended at the thought that God intentionally destroyed the old covenant way of worship using the Roman army to bring judgment upon the Jewish people. They're deeply offended. Hear me very carefully. God loves the Jews like He loves everyone. He loves all races. But the old way of worship is gone. It's been obliterated. It's disappeared. And the new way of worship, ordained by God, is to embrace the Messiah, to kiss His Son. How do we know that to be true? In your paper, I've shown you the prophecy that Jesus gave regarding the destruction of the temple, Matthew chapter 24. And He said, He predicted, not one stone would be left standing upon the other. And in that chapter, Matthew 24, which we'll be examining verse by verse in the weeks to come, He describes for us the end of the old covenant age. Most Christians make the mistake of thinking that Jesus is describing the end of the world in Matthew 24. No, 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 no. He's describing the end of the age of old covenant worship and the inauguration of the new age. Now, two things happened after the death of Jesus Christ, his burial and resurrection from the grave. Two things happened in Jewish worship that should confirm what Jesus Christ did for us at the cross is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets, and he inaugurated a new way to know God. Those two things that occurred, we find out about in Jewish writings. And again, they're in your handout for tonight. Number one, beginning in the fall of 30 AD. And remember, Jesus died in the spring of 30 AD at Calvary. Beginning in the fall on the Day of Atonement. You remember what the priest would do on that day? He would take a bag and put a white stone in it and a black stone in it, shake up the bag, reach in his right hand without looking into the bag, and pull out a stone. And the stone that he pulled out was either white or black. You say, well, what's the significance of it? Well, goats were offered on the Day of Atonement too. One was offered to the Lord. That was the white stone. The other stone was offered for the scapegoat. And you remember what would happen? The high priest would lay his hands on the head of the scapegoat, confess the sins of Israel, and then they would lose that goat out into the wilderness. The other goat would be the goat that was offered on the Day of Atonement to make atonement for the sins of God's people. And the word atonement means at one moment. Through the sacrifice, sinners became at one with God. That's the meaning of atonement. When Jesus Christ died, the fall of that year, 30 AD, for the next 40 consecutive years, the high priest drew the black stone. You know the odds of that happening 40 years in a row, of reaching into a bag and pulling out the black stone, the stone that represented the goat for the scapegoat, Azazel? Do you know what the odds of pulling that stone out 40 consecutive years are? Over 1 trillion to 1. Not one stone that had engraved on it, La Hashim, for the Lord, the white stone, was ever drawn. In addition, do you remember in the Old Testament, we are told in the book of Leviticus that when the scapegoat was let go, and then the other goat was offered to the Lord, do you remember that there was a scarlet thread that was tied around the horns of the goat that was offered and the neck of the goat that escaped? The priest would take a portion of that red wool, that scarlet thread, and they would tie it to the temple door. And during the course of the year, that red scarlet thread would turn white. The Jewish writings, after 40 AD, it's called the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud, the Jewish scholars who wrote about their own history, said that for the next 40 years, from the fall of 30 AD until the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, that scarlet thread tied to the temple door never turned white. Every year prior to 30 AD, the death of Christ, it always turned white. That never turned white for 40 years. You say, wait, what's the significance? Listen to me very carefully. The Jews themselves understood that something extraordinary had happened. What was it that happened? Well, they didn't understand the significance of the death of Christ. Do you remember what Isaiah the prophet said? Again, in your notes. Come, says the Lord, let us reason together. Though your sins be as scarlet, they will be made as white as snow. It seems to me what God was saying to the Jewish people for that 40 year of transitional time, the only way your sins will ever be forgiven, the only way you will ever be made right with me, at one with me, is to come to faith in the person and work of my Son. No longer is it the atonement of the old covenant. No longer is it the blood of bulls and goats. Oh, no, no. You are right with me through the work of my Son. The Jews rejected the Messiah. And 40 years after the resurrection of Christ, God brought the Roman army to destroy the temple and the city of Jerusalem and scatter the Jews. And now the good news of Jesus Christ goes into all the world, both to Jews and to Greeks. Now, we're going to look at how the Roman army destroyed the temple and destroyed the city of Jerusalem. Pay attention. This will be the only time we talk about the details of the battle and the war and the dispersion itself. You're going to hear some amazing things. What happened in Jerusalem? What happened in Masada? How Titus surrounded the city? But Jesus predicted this would happen in Matthew 24, and it came to pass exactly as he said. I hope you enjoy this film that Brian and I have put together for you. I will be here this Sunday as we continue our series on the face of grace, and then I'll be joining you next Wednesday night and then the Wednesday nights to come as we continue our look at AD 70. Enjoy this film, and when it's over, you'll be dismissed, and I hope you have a great week.
The Siege of Jerusalem was a massive military endeavor the likes of which had not been seen since the fall of Carthage 2 centuries earlier. Starting in April of 70 AD and lasting nearly 5 months, the battle would be a brutal, no-holds-barred brawl fought over every inch of the city. At stake was the success of the Great Revolt in Judea and the survival of the Jewish people. Roman involvement in Judea first began in 63 BC when Pompey the Great was drawn into a Jewish civil war and eventually seized Jerusalem. However, the region saw much turbulence during the final years of the Republic and was taken over by the Parthians before legions returned to install the puppet King Herod. Eventually, a series of procurators oversaw Judea, but these largely lacked the competency or military power to impose order. Roman authority was highly dependent on local elites who themselves often lacked the confidence or respect of the Jewish people. On top of this, the population of Judea was divided across lines of class, ethnic, and religious divisions. As a result, the region was highly unstable. Revolutions seemed perpetually around the corner. In May of 66 AD, rioting amongst the people was met by the heavy-handed overreaction of the Roman procurator Florus, who only further incensed the situation by plundering southwest Jerusalem and killing 3,600 people. As the situation escalated, reinforcements soon arrived from Caesarea, only to be driven out by a rebellion that now spread to the entire region. Jerusalem was taken by Jewish rebels, while Roman strongholds were eliminated in Judea and Perea. Roman efforts to combat the uprising were led by Vespasian and his son Titus, under orders from the Emperor Nero. The campaign season of 67 AD saw Vespasian advance south from Antioch and focus his efforts on subduing Galilee. Field battles were virtually unheard of, given the huge advantage the Romans held, and most of the fighting was concentrated around fortifications. This resulted in particularly brutal treatment of any populations which did not submit immediately. Rome often acted particularly strict to make a point. During the 68 AD offensive in Judea, for instance, cities downstream of the Roman army learned of their approach not by messengers, but by the arrival of bodies floating down the Jordan River. The campaign ground to a halt with the news of Nero's death. The anarchy that followed was known as the Year of Four Emperors and included a bid for power by Vespasian on July 1st, 69 AD. By the summer of 70 AD, he had come out the victor and set sail for Rome to claim his prize. Titus was left in command of the Judean campaign with instructions to put an end to the Jewish uprising. This, of course, meant the long-delayed assault on Jerusalem, home to the rebel leaders and the heart of the resistance. Titus began the Jerusalem campaign in the spring of 70 AD. His army of 4 legions was assembled in Alexandria and marched north to Caesarea along the shoreline. Supporting his force were 23 cohorts of auxiliary infantry, 8 ally of cavalry, and numerous detachments of local troops provided by the region's client rulers. Historical records seem to claim that this force numbered around 60,000 men. These estimates imply that the core legionary troops made up around 35% of the army, the auxiliary troops about 32%, and the remaining local forces about 33%. Such a high proportion of local troops does raise some doubts on the accuracy of our sources. However, we may speculate that local rulers were eager to donate men to the war effort in a political bid to secure Rome's goodwill amidst a bloody revolt. The Roman commanders themselves may also have been eager to have additional troops at their side. While the local forces were surely not as reliable as the crack legionaries, they could take on many responsibilities of the army and thus free up the elite troops to do what they did best. This would be especially important in the upcoming siege of a city as large and well fortified as Jerusalem. The Roman forces approached Jerusalem in separate marching columns due to the security and supply constraints of the Judean hill country. Titus led both the 12th and 15th legions by the most direct road, while the 5th Macedonica approached via Emmaus and the 10th Fratensis approached via Jericho. On April 23rd, the lead units of the 12th and 15th legions arrived on the hills to the north of the city. That night, the 5th Macedonica arrived, and by morning, the rest of the army entered the battlefield. Before them lay the great city with gleaming temples and stout battlements. The city of Jerusalem is surrounded on three sides by steep ravines. To the east lies the Kidron Valley, to the west, the Gihon Valley, and sweeping around the south is the Hinnom Valley. A series of hills surround the area, including the famed Mount of Olives to the east. Ancient Jerusalem itself was built atop several key topographic features. The city incorporated two spurs of land with the Tirupain Valley in between. Atop the eastern spur stood the Temple Mount and the Antonia Fortress. The heights of the western spur were occupied by the elites who had built the upper city during the Hasmonean and Herodian periods. In the middle of these two areas sprawled the more ancient and crowded lower city, which held most of the population. Both the upper and lower cities were enclosed by a wall, which was anchored on the flank by the massive fortifications around the Temple Mount. Inevitably, the population outgrew its bounds, and the second city was developed north of the first wall. This exposed position was soon surrounded by a second wall, which ran from the Antonia in the east to the Gennath Gate in the west. By the 1st century AD, yet another suburb had sprung up to the north, known as the New City. Once again, expansion necessitated fortifications, and in 41 AD, Herod Agrippa commissioned the construction of the third wall. This was an ambitious project with massive stone blocks meant to enclose a large area. It seems that the scale of the defensive works raised some suspicion amongst the Romans, who forced their client king to abandon the project before its completion. Over the course of the Jewish revolt, however, the people of Jerusalem managed to put the finishing touches on their third layer of battlements. By the time the legions arrived outside Jerusalem, the walls had been raised an additional 9 meters and a series of square towers were built projecting outwards. The combination of tough terrain and stout walls made for a formidable three-layered defensive network. Additionally, the maze of narrow streets between the fortifications could be easily blockaded, while numerous underground water and sewage passages meant that defenders could emerge from any direction for a surprise attack on intruders. Bunkered within this massive, fortified city was a garrison of approximately 20,000 Jewish troops. However, these were not professional forces. Rather, they were a motley assortment of militiamen, refugees, and zealots. This composition is a reflection of the thoroughly fractured nature of the Jewish resistance. Since the outbreak of the revolt, an effective, centralized government had failed to take form, and the resistance suffered from a chronic failure to synergize its various factions. Jerusalem had been divided along party lines and was tearing itself apart in bloody political infighting right up until the arrival of Roman forces. The principal leaders were Simon Gioras, who laid claim to the upper city, and John of Gischala, who was based out of the Temple Mount. Simon led the larger of the two forces, which included 10,000 men under 50 officers and 6,000 allied Idumeans under 8 commanders. These troops garrisoned the first wall from the Kidron all the way to the Palace of the Kings. On the other side of the city, John had an armed following of around 6,000 men under 20 officers and was joined by Eleazar with his 2,400 zealots. These forces held the Temple Mount, along with the surrounding neighborhoods including the Ophel and the Tirupain Valley. Traditional Jewish fighters were lightly armed and armored. They fought at range with slings, bows, and javelins before closing in with spears, swords, and clubs. While agile and determined, they often stood no chance in a straight-up engagement against Roman forces, especially heavy cavalry. However, the Jews in Jerusalem were much better prepared than was typical. They had been amassing equipment from Jewish workshops, Herodian armories, arms dealers, deserters, and defeated enemies. A substantial amount of gear had been gathered from the defeated Romans at Beth Horon, including an array of artillery pieces. In addition, the confused mess of siege warfare would negate many of the advantages a Roman force would enjoy in a field battle. Lastly, it must be said that the morale of the defenders was strengthened by the inevitable survival instincts that took hold when a city resolved to fight or die. While considering the armies is important, we would do well to remember that sieges are battles of attrition. As such, it is necessary to ask about the food and water supplies. Fresh water, at least, was not of immediate concern, owing to the presence of numerous cisterns around the city, as well as several massive pools which trapped rainwater. Food, on the other hand, was in short supply. During the infighting that preceded the siege, many of the grain stores had been raided or destroyed by opposing parties. In addition, the already huge population of Jerusalem had swelled to dangerous levels in recent weeks with the arrival of pilgrims celebrating Passover. The non-combatant populace far outnumbered the armed defenders and imposed severe limitations on the length supplies could last. Once the Romans closed in on Jerusalem, the countdown began. The Roman army had undergone a long march to reach Jerusalem. Titus recognized that his men were exhausted and ordered that they construct preliminary camps out of range of the city. The 12th and 15th legions, who had arrived from the northeast, began to set up a kilometer away, atop Mount Scopus, with another camp planned for the 5th Macedonica, 550 meters further back. As the legions moved into place, Titus rode ahead to personally survey the defenses. On the morning of April 23rd, he set off with 600 horsemen, following the road that led to the main gate of the third wall. However, the terrain was uneven and cluttered with gardens, olive groves, hedges, fences, walls, and stone structures which had been knocked down by the defenders. In other words, he walked into a maze of obstacles. All of a sudden, Jewish forces burst out of the gate and swarmed the Roman column, cutting it in half. Cavalrymen in the rear bolted out into the open country they had come from. Meanwhile, Titus and his escorts were left behind. The general had neglected to wear his helmet or breastplate for the expedition, but nonetheless drew his sword and led a charge to break out. According to Josephus, he, quote, diverted those perpetually with his sword that came on his side, overturned many of those that directly met him, and made his horse ride over those that were overthrown, end quote. The encounter was a close call, but ultimately the Romans were able to cut their way through, though they lost several men and left many injured. Titus was likely shaken by the event and eager to get the siege underway. He ordered the 10th Fortensis to move even closer and began constructing entrenchments atop the Mount of Olives. However, the Jews were emboldened by their near success and decided to follow up with a massive assault. Sorties poured out of the eastern and southern gateways, their sights set on the working legionaries. Fighters streamed across the Kidron Valley and descended upon the half-built camp of the 10th Fortensis. The Romans were caught completely off guard. Jewish troops started cutting down their disorganized opponents while more reinforcements rushed out from the city to complete the rout. Titus attacked the flank with his bodyguard, which was enough to force the mob back down the ravine. The 10th Fortensis resumed work, only to come under a second assault from Jews who had been steadily bringing in more and more men. This ferocious attack overwhelmed the Roman force on the low ground. Many of the soldiers fled for the heights, while Titus and a band of troops attempted to hold the line. Soon after, the legionaries regrouped and countercharged down the hill, driving the Jews back once more. In the ensuing lull, the camp fortifications were finally completed. This secured the Roman forward position, but left everyone with a reminder that the strength of the Jewish defense had been dangerously underestimated. In response, Titus now took precautions against further counterattacks. He posted cavalry divisions to deflect attacks and ordered that the ground between the Roman camps and the walls be cleared of all obstructions. This meant cutting down trees, flattening hedges, filling in ditches, and destroying rock projections. This had the dual purpose of removing any cover for Jewish sorties, as well as preparing the ground for siege works. The Roman army had effectively rolled up its sleeves. It was time to get to work. Titus recognized the hardship of attacking from the east, where the ravines were steepest. As a result, he decided to focus on the western flank of the third wall. The 10th Fortensis was left to hold the Mount of Olives, while the three remaining legions were redeployed. The 5th Macedonica built a camp 400 meters west of the western gate, while the 12th and 15th legions established themselves opposite the Sophinus Tower. Artillery positions were now deployed with their sights set on the city. Under their covering fire, each legion began constructing an earth and timber ramp up to the third wall. Jewish projectiles rained down from above, and attack parties slowed construction at all times of night and day. However, the concentrated might of the three legions with artillery support proved too much. The attackers completed their ramps, and soon were slowly rolling battering rams into place. The thudding of the rams signaled progress for the Romans, but also served as a rallying cry for the defenders. Militia units from around the city swarmed into place to pelt the crews and their guards with missiles from above, while raiding parties attacked the engines on foot from postern doors. Brave defenders fought their way up to the ramp's protective sheds and were poised to destroy the equipment before Titus led a cavalry attack to drive them off. Before ramming was resumed, Roman engineers built three siege towers, which were too heavy to be overturned, and which were also fireproofed. These were then rolled into place to provide close fire support for construction and clear the area of defenders. On the 15th day of the siege, the rams broke through the third wall. The Jews yielded the outer city to the Romans and withdrew to the second wall. Titus was eager to keep the momentum rolling and established a camp in the heart of the new city, tearing down many structures in the process. The rams were now brought into position once again and targeted the central tower gate. Within 4 days, a breach was formed. The legionaries formed up and advanced through the narrow gap. However, they were met with an eerie silence. As the troops advanced cautiously through the seemingly deserted streets, they were all of a sudden attacked from all directions. The trap was now sprung, and Jews began unleashing barrages of missiles into the dense infantry clusters. At the same time, hit-and-run parties attacked any exposed troops who had strayed too far from the main body. In shock, the Romans attempted to retreat back through the breach but found that it was so narrow that only a few men could get through at a time. This choke point was a prime target for the bowmen and slingers of the defenders. Roman archer units were brought up to provide covering fire and eased up enough pressure to allow for a withdrawal. At the same time, however, the Jewish force was mobilized to surge ahead as the Roman tide receded. They rushed back onto the walls, unloading continual barrages onto the attackers. Meanwhile, sorties with large blocks of Jews pressed the Romans back while the breach was mended. Josephus recalls that the fighting raged all day long and into the night. Action around the tower gate continued, and by the fourth day, the legions once again broke through. This time, Titus ordered that the entire northern stretch of the second wall be torn down and the surrounding towers be manned by Roman forces. The Jews now pulled back to the first wall. This was part of a deliberate plan to carry out a fighting retreat against the Romans, conserving Jewish strength while maximizing their damage. The commanders were finally in a position to make a stand now that the defensive line had a much smaller surface area than at the start of the siege. This meant that the outnumbered Jews could far more readily concentrate forces and rebuff attacks. At this point, overall command of the defense had been granted to Simon, who held the first wall along the northern side up to the royal palace. John's, Galileans, and Zealots held the Temple Mount and the Antonia Fortress on the eastern edge of the line. The legions advanced into the second city. Titus dispatched the 10th and 15th legions to raise ramps to the west, where the 2nd and 1st walls met. To the east, he had the 5th and 12th legions start construction against the Antonia Fortress. They did so under incessant sorties and missile attacks. Historians tell us that the Jewish forces at this point would have been able to bring to bear 300 bolt throwers and 40 stone throwers from the rebel armory. This firepower was considerable and must have forced the Romans to build their own protective countermeasures. On the 29th of May, after 17 days of intense labor and non-stop harassment, the Romans completed their attack paths up to the eastern and western flanks. Battering rams, siege towers, and numerous cohorts were brought up for an all-out assault. However, unbeknownst to the Romans, the Jewish forces had been hard at work themselves. They had secretly conducted sapping operations with a tunnel traveling under the first wall right up to the siege ramps against the Antonia. The excavations were supported by pit props, which the Jews set alight. As the fire took its course, the ground gave way and a huge chasm opened up, engulfing the ramps and their siege engines. Fires, which were temporarily smothered, erupted once more as the bitumen reignited and burned what remained of the equipment. The Romans had once again fatally underestimated the defenders and were reaping the consequences. To the west, Simon sallied out at night to attack the siege works in his sector of the battlefield. The brave rebels beat back resistance and fought their way to the ramps, setting their sheds alight. The fires alarmed the legionaries, who saw their hard work going up in smoke and rushed in to try and pull the rams out of harm's way. They were met by Jewish reinforcements streaming out from postern gates, and a pitched battle ensued. A deadly tug of war followed over the rams, with the rebels finally managing to complete their destruction. The demoralized Romans pulled back. Sensing an opportunity, the Jewish forces swarmed out of the city in pursuit, driving the legions all the way back to their camp. The retreat was stabilized when once again, Titus rode to the rescue with his cavalry. Fierce fighting ensued, but the rebels were finally pushed back to the first wall. The Roman siege lines were in shambles. Virtually all of their rams and ramps were a smoldering ruin by morning, and the morale of the legions must have been in a similar state. It was approaching the hottest part of the year now. Water was running low, and building material was becoming increasingly hard to come by. Nonetheless, Titus launched an ambitious plan to restore the spirit and security of the men. His plan called for the construction of an 8-kilometer wall of circumvallation with 13 forts. To do this, he leveraged the proud nature of the troops by having the legions and cohorts challenge one another for the honor of being the first to complete their allotted portion of the wall. Relatively safe from Jewish attacks, the legionaries were free to reforge their unit cohesion through competitive labor. The result was a stunning success. Within 3 days, the entire structure was completed. Morale amongst the Romans was restored, while the Jews were left with a stunning sign that the Roman war machine wasn't backing down. If anything, things had just shifted into high gear. With the completion of the Wall of Circumvallation, the noose around Jerusalem was finally pulled tight. Previously, citizens had been able to slip out at night to collect supplies from the countryside, but now this proved impossible. Any rebels caught outside the walls were crucified as a terrifying example of Rome's wrath, while even those who defected willingly were often gutted by troops who believed their stomachs would be filled with precious items ingested for concealment. Inside, the food situation rapidly deteriorated. The defenders were reduced to eating pets and boiling hay. Disturbing reports also mentioned instances of infantile cannibalism taking place. Now, in the 10th week of the siege, Titus ordered all forces to concentrate their assault on the Antonia Fortress. The full-scale assault began with the mobilization of archers and artillery to suppress the walls, while two battering rams moved into position and men armed with crowbars took aim at the foundation blocks of the towers. Despite great efforts made the first day, the Romans were forced to withdraw for the night without making any noticeable gains. Unbeknownst to both sides, however, the heavy activity in the area took a toll on the structural stability of the fortress. The mine, which had previously brought down the Roman siege ramps, had also undermined the Antonia. A heavy rain, combined with the pressure of the men and the machinery at work, provided the straw that broke the camel's back. In the dead of night, the northern wall of the fortress collapsed. At first light, the Romans positioned themselves for a direct assault through the breach. Once again, however, the Jews were one step ahead and had already constructed another secondary wall on the other side. Unwilling to give up the nighttime gift, Titus asked for volunteers to tackle the fortifications head on. A handful of brave men volunteered, no doubt encouraged by the promise of rich reward. This gang took heavy fire as they ran up to the barricade, but managed to scramble over the top. The attackers proved too few, and with no reinforcements on the way, were inevitably slaughtered. The failure of this mission in full sight of the Roman army sapped their will to fight. A tentative stalemate ensued. 2 days later, in the early morning, 24 enterprising Romans, including a standard bearer from the 5th Macedonica and a trumpeter, decided to attack on their own initiative. The men silently climbed the ruins of the Antonia Fortress and slit the throats of the sentries. With the barricade now secured, the trumpeter sounded a signal. This blast within the walls threw the Jews into a panic as they jolted awake from their sleep. Imagining that the entire Roman army was upon them, they fled to the Temple Mount. Meanwhile, the Roman command was equally confused but knew something had to be done. Titus, along with his officers, collected picked men from the units and immediately sent them towards the sound of the trumpet. When the Jews realized that the Romans were not hot on their heels, cooler heads prevailed and they rallied. Militias streamed into the courtyard as it soon became apparent that the real Roman forces would now certainly be on their way. If they gained a foothold in the sanctuary, all was lost. Both sides realized that this was the case and plunged into the darkness towards the passages linking the Antonia to the Temple Mount. Brutal fighting occurred in the close quarter confines that dragged on for nearly 10 hours. In the end, the fury of the Jews, fed by constant reinforcements, prevailed over the Romans, who sounded the retreat, thus ending the first battle of the temple. Titus ordered the men to raise the Antonia on his side of the battle lines, and within a week was ready to renew the attack. 7,200 legionaries, picked from 30 of the best troops from each century, were mustered at night on July 17th. These men silently shuffled towards the ruins of the Antonia for a surprise attack. Jewish sentries, however, picked up on the advance and sounded the alarm. In some areas, Roman forces were able to cut their way past the previous week's high water mark. However, in the obscurity of the night, chaos reigned. This was made even worse by the fact that the rebels had equipped themselves with captured Roman gear to the point that many legionaries and Jewish units ended up bumping into and fighting friendly forces. The combat was so confused that it proved virtually impossible to capitalize on any gains either side made. When the sun eventually began to rise, some degree of order was finally restored.
Josephus reports that both sides now separated and drew up into ragged battle lines at the edges of the sanctuary's northern edge. Missiles began to fly, and a savage pitched battle developed. Titus attempted to orchestrate an organized attack, but the tight confines again rendered this futile. By midday, it became apparent that no gains would be made, and the second battle of the temple was called off. Clearly, it would be impossible to punch a hole through the Jewish bottleneck. Titus thus resolved to broaden the scale of the attack. In the peak of the summer heat, he ordered 4 more ramps to be built against the northwestern corner of the Temple Mount. In response, the Jews massed their missiles at the walls and sent forth continuous waves of skirmishers and sorties to harass the work crews. Nonetheless, the legion steadily made progress. With the works nearing completion, the defenders tore down the northwestern corner of the temple colonnade, severing connection between the defensive parapets and the remaining elements of the Antonia. This effectively removed a key avenue the Romans were hoping to use as an attack route. At the same time, a major sally was attempted against the Roman wall of circumvallation at the Mount of Olives. Though unsuccessful, this assault once again attested to the boldness of the defenders. A cornered beast was certainly a force to be reckoned with. On the 27th of July, Roman work parties building a ramp against the broken end of the western colonnade spotted an opportunity. It appeared that Jewish activity on the other fronts had caused a withdrawal of defensive forces in the area. The legions rushed forward with ladders for an immediate assault by escalade. Hundreds of troops now swarmed onto the undefended walls, with many more following behind them. However, the Jewish retreat had been a trap. In the previous days, they had secretly filled the rafters with dry wood and bitumen, which they now set alight. The entire sector of the wall burst into flames, with the Roman assault troops caught in the inferno. This occurred in sight of both armies and provided a tremendous morale boost to the defenders. The Romans proved wary of another escalade assault and instead tried to breach the walls with rams and picks. For days, they worked around the clock in relays to undermine the defensive fortifications. They did so under a continuous bombardment of missiles and harassment. Eventually, several huge blocks were pried loose, but the thick construction of the Temple Mount defied all attempts at destruction. Titus must have been unimaginably frustrated. Desperate for results, he ordered another storming of the walls. The results were predictably bloody. Roman troops climbing the ladders were dangerously exposed. Many found themselves toppled in their attempts to scale the walls, while others finally managed to reach the top under continual artillery and archer covering fire, only to be left isolated. Those that did make it up were vastly outnumbered and slaughtered. Roman centurions resorted to throwing legionary eagles onto the walls in a bid to motivate the proud soldiers to retrieve them. However, even this desperate measure proved fruitless and only resulted in the death of even more bullheaded attackers. The increasingly costly assault was abandoned. Rather than abandon all hope, Titus made preparations for yet another attack on the temple in the beginning of August. The objective would be to finally push through the bottleneck at the Antonia and move out onto the open spaces of the courtyard, where the legions would gain the necessary space to fight effectively. Archers and artillery were massed in and around the ruins of the Antonia. These began to target the defenders holding out at the north end of the temple complex. Once they had cleared, Roman troops burnt out and tore down the entire northern colonnade. This would allow the attackers to deploy along the entire width of the plaza, while at the same time stripping away a crucial Jewish defensive position. While the northern battlements were now destroyed, sight lines were opened up onto the other flanking battlement positions. The defenders stationed here found themselves dangerously exposed and were forced to pull back. The Jewish line of defense was reformed and now cut across the center of the Temple Mount, with the temple itself serving as a central bastion. It is around this time that the gravest of ill omens took place. This spiritual crisis involved the daily sacrifice of lamb to Yahweh. Like clockwork, the priests had upheld the holy rite of Tammid amidst the bloodshed and starvation of the siege. But on the 5th of August, the last of the sacrificial lambs ran out. Now, at the height of the siege, with the Romans advancing, the Jews lost their connection to God. In 73 AD, Masada,
The impregnable mountain fortress in the Judean desert stood as the final holdout against the onslaught of Rome's legions. The siege that followed would mark the final, bloody suppression of the Jewish revolt with an encounter whose awe-inspiring remains can still be seen in the desert today. Prior to the Jewish revolt, Judea was a minor Roman province under the administration of a procurator and under the overall control of the governor of Syria. The region had long been divided along ethnic, religious, and class divisions, and was made even more unstable by a Roman authority which lacked the competency or military power to impose proper order. Simply put, the region was a highly combustible powder keg waiting to go off. In 66 AD, a local riot in Caesarea morphed into an anti-tax protest which challenged Roman rule. In response, the procurator Gessius Florus responded with heavy-handed retribution, plundering southwest Jerusalem and killing 3,600 people. The revolutionary spark was lit, and the situation quickly spiraled out of control. A wave of communal violence surged through the entire region, with the population of Judea splintering along its divisions. Amidst the chaos, the Jewish rebels drove the Romans from Jerusalem and eliminated garrisons throughout the province. This included the capture of the fortress at Masada by radical Sicarii rebels. The Great Jewish Revolt would last 8 years and involve the personal command of two future emperors, Vespasian and his son Titus. Incredible amounts of blood would be spilled in a campaign that revolved primarily around sieges. This was epitomized by the epic siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD, which Josephus claims killed 1.1 million people, with another 97,000 captured and enslaved. While these numbers are dismissed by historians, they do attest to the intense levels of violence accompanying the fall of the city and the revolt as a whole. While the destruction of Jerusalem ended the organized resistance of Jewish forces, the fires of revolution still burned in the fringes of Judea, where the diehard rebels holed up in fortresses refused to surrender. When Titus set sail for Rome in 71 AD, he left the new military governor, Lucilius Bassus, to conduct mopping up operations. Bassus took command of the 10th Fortensis Legion and marched first on the garrison at Herodium, followed swiftly by Hebron. He then swung the legions around the east side of the Dead Sea to take the hill fortress of Machaerus, before returning west to destroy 3,000 rebels hiding in the forest of Jardes in the Jordan Valley. Now, only the stronghold of Masada remained. However, Bassus soon died of natural causes, and the legion returned to its new base at Jerusalem, before setting out with a new commander, Flavius Silva, in 73 AD. This force now marched south, intent on terminating the last of the Jewish resistance. Masada lies 2.4 kilometers from the Dead Sea on a barren, flat-top limestone mountain amidst a desolate landscape. On its eastern side, the summit rises 140 meters above the desert floor, roughly half the height of the Eiffel Tower. Here, a tortuous, zigzagging trail known as the Serpent Path makes its way to the top. By comparison, the western approach is more assailable, and yet even this side towers 80 meters above the surrounding landscape, the approximate height of the Statue of Liberty. As if natural defenses weren't enough, the cleared plateau at the top was ringed with a 1,400 meter long casemate wall standing 6 meters tall. The wall design was such that it was actually made of two parallel layers with a central gap that could be filled with stones or dirt during a siege. Such walls were common in antiquity as they were cheaper and faster to construct while also doubling as storage space. In the case of Masada, the outer wall was 1.4 meters thick and the inner was 1 meter, making for a combined width of 4 meters. The walls were reinforced by 30 towers, spaced out for topographic and strategic reasons. These were generally 6 meters wide and 20 meters tall, with stairs leading to the top. The entire defensive structure could only be crossed at four points: the Snake Path Gate, the Water Gate, the Western Gate, and the Cistern Gate. As with all impregnable fortresses, the Achilles heel of any defense would be access to food and water for the defenders. However, Masada was well prepared in this respect. Cut into the rock were numerous cisterns and reservoirs. 12 were constructed in two rows along the northwestern slopes with a total capacity of 40,000 cubic meters or 16 Olympic pools. Buildings also dotted the top of the plateau with a series of long storehouses built into the northern complex. These could hold large quantities of corn, oil, wine, dates, and food supplies that would be preserved for long periods of time due to the naturally dry climate. Even if stockpiles began to run low, the open plateau area might be used to grow additional food. It's safe to say that a defensive force could expect to hold out indefinitely against just about any attacker. Unfortunately for the Jews, the Roman army wasn't your average foe. In fact, the Roman force bearing down on Masada had at its core the 10th Fortensis Legion. This unit of 4,800 men was a descendant of Julius Caesar's famed 10th Legion and was adorned with numerous battle honors. Recently, it had been blooded by campaigns in Armenia and was battle-hardened by the siege of Jerusalem. This grizzled legion was joined by 6 auxiliary cohorts and thousands of Jewish prisoners of war. In total, Silva arrived at Masada with a force of nearly 10,000. Bunkered atop the fortress, looking down on the incoming troops, would be a defensive garrison of less than 1,000. Even this number is inflated since a large part of Masada's occupants were actually refugees. These women and children were certainly not dead weight, and could have helped with defensive operations under the guidance of the Jewish commander Eleazar ben Yair. Eleazar was an important figure in the Jewish revolt and was one of the principal leaders of the Sicarii, who now made up the main fighting force at Masada. These troops were a splinter group of the Hebrew Zealots and whose name means literally dagger men. They were fierce resistance forces, made famous for being one of the earliest organized assassination units that would strike their targets in public gatherings before disappearing into the crowd. Such zealots had successfully held the Romans at bay and even defeated them in the past, despite being poorly equipped, and were not to be underestimated. When the Romans arrived in the autumn of 73 AD, they had no illusions that the siege would be over quickly. With this understanding, they set up camp on the western approach and went about securing their own position whilst undermining the defenders. First, the Romans targeted the aqueducts serving the fortress and diverted them for their own use. Next, they set to work constructing a wall of circumvallation. This was a textbook Roman operation meant to encircle enemy positions. The fortification would ensure that defenders were cut off from the outside world and help thwart attempts at a breakout. During the siege of Jerusalem, Titus had failed to construct such a wall from the get-go and was harassed mercilessly by Jewish sorties. Silva was determined not to make the same mistake and put his men to work immediately. Using pickaxes and entrenching tools, the Romans quarried local stones and erected a 3-meter wall which ran 3.2 kilometers. This was reinforced by 8 camps and numerous guard posts. In addition, a string of towers helped shore up defenses on the more exposed eastern valley. This impressive network was built in a matter of days and can be clearly seen in the desert today. Silva established his headquarters on the higher ground to the west, along with legionary cohorts 1 through 5, while cohorts 6 through 10 took residence on the low ground to the east. The remainder of the auxiliary forces were then stationed in the surrounding minor camps, thus ensuring that troops completely surrounded the fortress. Now that the attackers had their prey cornered, it was time to close in for the kill. The Romans decided that taking the fortress by force would be necessary, since their own supplies would run out long before those of the defenders. But the question still remained of how best to assault a mountaintop. A quick storming of the walls with ladders was out of the question, since any attack would be forced to advance at a dangerously slow pace and would be funneled through narrow killing fields. In this scenario, the defenders would be at a huge advantage, and any outcome would be pyrrhic at best. Typically, Roman forces would overcome such adversity by using siege equipment to offer protection from projectiles whilst artillery suppressed the defenders. However, the terrain at Masada was far too steep for siege equipment and too high for artillery. It would therefore be necessary to not only overcome the defenders, but nature itself. Ultimately, the Romans decided to turn the rocky cliffside into a gradual highway for an assault. To do this, the engineers would build an enormous siege ramp by taking advantage of a natural spur called the White Rock on the western side of the mountain. The plan was to bridge the existing gulf up to the walls with a man-made 20-degree incline. To support a ramp of this scale, the base had to be huge, so as not to collapse under its own weight, and was started roughly 200 meters out from the cliff. Here, the 10th Fortensis took the lead in construction while Jewish prisoners were used to bring a continual stream of water and supplies to the camps. Day in and day out, they slowly added more and more material to the foundation. At first, the volume being added would do little to increase the height of the ramp, but as the days, weeks, and months rolled by, it only grew faster and faster. The sheer audacity of the construction project must have awed the defenders, who woke up every morning to a mountain slowly rising towards their walls. However, as the ramp got closer and closer, it meant that workers were more and more vulnerable to projectiles launched from the walls and towers above. In response, the Romans surely would have begun to erect temporary walls and sheds to cover their progress. Additional archers and artillery may also have been called up to provide covering fire for the work crews and to dissuade counterattacks. Within 2 months, the ramp to the fortress was complete. It measured 220 meters wide at its base, rose 90 meters, and was topped with a 20-meter stone pier nearest the wall. According to archaeologists, this obscenely large amount of earthwork weighed the equivalent of 1.5 times the Empire State Building. It is stunning to imagine that this was accomplished without the use of modern equipment. Now, a 25-meter siege tower was constructed and slowly rolled up the ramp. It was specifically designed to handle the angled slope and included a battering ram at the front. The tower likely also carried small artillery pieces, which could be used to shoot down at the enemy walls which it now overlooked. It is important to note that this was often the primary purpose of siege towers. Rather than being glorified elevators for infantry assaults, they were actually meant to provide elevated positions for sniping at defenders and forcing them away from the walls while a larger breach was formed. In the case of Masada, the siege tower guarded the battering ram, which started to break down the walls. In response, the defenders set about reinforcing their defenses. When the Roman ram broke through the main wall, the attackers were faced with a second, hastily erected wall made of alternating layers of wood and earth. This wall proved far more resilient to the battering ram, seemingly absorbing every blow. It was, however, flammable, and so the Romans set fire to the timbers. Though the flames caught on, the wind changed direction and blew the flames back onto the siege tower, setting it alight. The attackers now faced the devastating prospect of having their equipment destroyed without having set foot within the fortress. Fortunes once again shifted, however, and the wind reversed direction, concentrating the fire back onto the inner wall. By nightfall, the defenses were sufficiently weakened, and the legionaries made preparations for a full force assault the next day. As the sun rose over Masada on the 3rd of May, the 10th Fortensis Legion stormed through the wall and burst out onto the plateau. Rather than being met by screams and shouts, however, they faced a deafening silence. The complex was filled with bodies of dead Jews. According to the historian Josephus, the defenders had accepted the inevitability of their fate and chosen death rather than capture. The grisly details of this mass suicide were apparently recounted by the handful of women and children who evaded the slaughter. More recent historical findings, however, have found discrepancies with Josephus' story and cast doubt on the final fate of the defenders. Nonetheless, the symbolism of a heroic Jewish last stand against oppressors lives on to this day and is a point of pride for the Israeli Defense Force recruits who take a vow never to let Masada fall again. The fall of Masada in 73 AD brought an end to the Great Jewish Revolt, which had raged on for 8 years. The land of Judea now became an independent Roman province under the administration of its own governor. However, The overwhelming use of force did little to quell the tensions which permeated the region. In the following years, the Jews would rise up twice more, only to be beaten mercilessly into submission with immense casualties. According to Cassius Dio, 50 of the most important Jewish strongholds and 985 of the better known villages were razed to the ground. Teaching the Torah was forbidden, and the province was renamed Syria Palestrina. This effectively marked the beginning of the diaspora and extinguished the idea of a Jewish state for the next 1800 years. Throughout the struggle, and especially at Masada, we are confronted with feelings of both great awe and sadness. The feats of engineering displayed by the Romans undeniably capture our imagination, and yet at the same time ring hollow in our hearts given the ultimately destructive purpose of these engines. For me, the Siege of Masada and its 2,000-year-old remains are a striking testament to the lengths our species will go to kill one another. As an admirer of the Roman war machine, this is a particularly important reminder of the field of corpses it left behind. Personal human tragedies rarely shine through the fog of history, and we would do well not to forget them. After all, one day, we will find ourselves in such books.